Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Saka! Oh, il est là! Saka! Oh, il est là! Saka! Bukayo! Bukayo! Saka!
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you, and I say it's a goodly morning because the weather is warm, and I really like warm weather, and I know some people struggle with the heat a little bit, but I find it hard to sympathize because we don't get enough of the warm weather, so it's a goodly morning. Are you feeling goodly or slightly too moist?
What a question. I feel mainly goodly because I'm not at work, so the scheduling gods have been kind to me. I've ended up having kind of a longer weekend today. I'm not filming. I've just had a text off my mate Tom, who does Horrible Histories with me, and he's having to get dressed up as Henry VIII today, replete with fat suit, about four layers of sort of thick woolen clothing, a fake beard. So I feel like I've really won the lottery by not being there and not having to do anything like that. So I cannot complain at all.
Yeah, okay. That sounds like a chore on a day like today. The work of an actor, eh?
Yeah, I know. It's the hardest job in the world, isn't it? Famously. It's like being down a mine or something, you know, really hard labour.
Yeah.
But no, it is a beautiful day. I took the dog out very much more.
Hello, you dropped out there.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
You said you took the dog out early. Was that it?
Pretty much, yeah. Took the dog out early. I'll take the dog out late. She doesn't do very well in the heat of the day. She and I have that in common, basically. So we'll be hiding in the shade in the midday sun.
Yeah.
But yeah, beautiful day. And people have had a good bank holiday weekend. And guess what?
What?
In the UK, the pandemic is over. As of this morning, Freedom Day is here. COVID, what COVID, etc.
Good news, I guess. yeah, look, it's tough for the dogs, I have to say, at the moment in this hot weather. Ours are going out early. We just take them up this little park up the road and they just get in the river. There's a little, well, river sounds quite impressive. It is, you know, technically a river, but it's very small. It's more like a stream kind of a thing. So they get in there and they paddle around and Archer lies down. They're quite noisy this morning as well. So there might be some barking in the background. There's a cat across the road being very provocative.
Sure. By flirting with them.
No, it's existing. It has the temerity to simply be a cat on the other side of the road. Archer doesn't really give a fuck, but Lana takes great umbrage at this cat. Yes, she really does. So there's going
to
be some noise maybe from downstairs. There we go.
That's fine. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Hang on. What are you barking at? Yeah. That's the cat is across the road bark. So
can the cat hear this barking, or is it sufficiently insulated?
Well, it probably can, but it doesn't seem to care.
No.
The window is closed. It's a pretty good window. The cat's in no danger. The only thing that's in danger is, you know, the TV, the broadband router, because Lana stands up right beside it. And she can get very cross about this. So sometimes things, yeah, they could take a whack. So if I get cut off in the middle of this, it's because she has probably just destroyed the router by accident by trying to go through the window. So
honestly, the temerity of this cat breathing, walking, yeah. doing all its catty business.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And there's our friend with the leaf blower, whatever it is.
It wouldn't be Monday morning without him.
Certainly wouldn't.
I still haven't killed him.
Well, you are a more tolerant and better person than many of us. Tell me this. Did you catch any of Arsenal versus Rangers, Rangers versus Arsenal at the weekend?
Yeah, I watched... Well, I kind of watched the entirety of it. Mm. I have to be honest, as it got into the second half, my attention was drifting somewhat as the kind of multitude of substitutions turned the game into much more of a kind of training exercise than an actual competitive spectacle. But I did watch it. We were exchanging messages, mourning the loss of Andreas Jorgensen and our immaculate defensive set pieces.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did. And it was... I was sort of surprised, actually, how so many of the squad are back already. You know, it kind of feels like, oh, you know, that's sort of a...
Yeah, yeah.
I recognise these players. It wasn't like, you know, 15-year-olds out there. This was sort of a relatively senior side.
Yeah, I mean, those are the guys who really didn't do anything in the summer or didn't have any international obligations, I guess, in the summer. And I suppose that there'll be, you know, one or two of them back for the trip to America. What happens with Granit Xhaka? Does he get more holidays? Is he allowed off? Is he, you know, what's happening if this Roma thing doesn't happen? Does he come back?
Yeah, good question. I mean, a lot of clubs have a kind of notional deadline for deals in their mind where ideally they don't want players, you know, coming back to training or joining up for training with their old teams. I think next week a lot of the Euros players, end of this week, come back to their clubs. Mm. And so I guess that will be in their mind. But, you know, if we know anything about Xhaka, it's that he's one of those kind of behind-the-scenes good pros. So I imagine he'll tag along and try to keep a low profile, essentially.
Mm.
I mean, there doesn't seem to be any major developments on that one.
No, not yet.
You know, Roma's clearly trying to screw us on the money. I suppose the only surprise is that we've not just accepted it at this point.
Yeah, well, look, we might get to a point where that happens. We'll probably talk a bit more on transfers later, but let's get back to the excitement of Ibrox and Rangers versus Arsenal. And yes, this, you know, do you read much into this set-piece thing? Is it a case that, you know, now that the guy is gone and the new guy has come in, it's all higgledy-piggledy up in the air, nobody knows what they're supposed to be doing from set pieces, or is it just kind of a bit of pre-season rustiness and coincidence that three of the four goals we've conceded during our two games in Scotland have been from set pieces? I mean, we looked weak, didn't we? I mean, I know we conceded a couple, but there were also a couple more where we didn't win the ball, we didn't compete as well as you would expect.
No. And I think, but the problem is, I mean, has the new guy had enough time for it to be in any way related to him, you know? Unless he's come in and undone work that the previous coach had done, if he's been like, no, we're going to do something different, and that's led to a bit of confusion, I guess that's a possibility. But, you know, he's barely had a week or so working with them, so I'd be surprised if we can lay it too much at his feet. I mean, maybe it's just one of those things of, you know, lack of organisation, players are just back to training, maybe not as switched on, maybe not as sharp physically. But certainly, I mean, it was a problem and has been a problem across the two games. I suppose just odd, given that, you know, defensively, that's where we were strong last season.
Yeah.
Set pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it can often work like that. When you seem to sort one thing out, something else comes along and becomes a problem. But look, we'll wait and see what happens during the season to make any definitive judgments on set pieces and our ability to deal with them. Let's see what else could we talk about. Well, obviously, Nuno Tavares got his first Arsenal goal. It was our first chance to see him in the red and white of Ajax. So what did you make of him? I know you can't... Nobody can say, like, definitively about a player after whatever he played half an hour or one half or whatever. Maybe he played a bit more than that, but, you know, in a game like this, you can't jump to any real conclusions, but just some early thoughts on him?
Well, he's a man of his word. I mean, when he signed for the club, he did an interview, said, you know, I'm good at going forward, and occasionally I can score goals with my right foot.
Mm.
And he delivered on that within minutes of his first appearance. So that was quite impressive. Thoughts on him? I actually thought he looked relatively raw at times, but he physically is quite an imposing figure. He's taller than you might expect of a fullback. He's clearly quick as well.
Mm.
So, you know, I think there are some positive raw attributes there, but I think, as you would expect of a 19-year-old, you know, there are elements of his game that will need honing. Mm. I guess, you know, unlike with Shahid Klasinac, there is at least a realistic prospect that might happen over the next few years.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I thought it was fine. He looked fine in a game like this. I could be wrong, but I think once or twice, I think I saw him struggle a little bit to get back, having made a foray forward, and that could be just fitness and pre-season work that gets done. But, you know, good goal. I liked the way he celebrated the goal, not by actually celebrating. He just ran in, picked the ball up, and headed back towards the center circle, which is good. I like it. You know, none of this frippery of celebrating a goal in preseason. You know, manly handshake, slap on the back, away you go again. You know, that's the way it should be, I think.
Yeah, I thought that was, you know, what you would want to see from a player, business-like in that situation.
Yes, business-like, that's it. I mean, in stark contrast to the captain, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who, look, on the one hand, had chances to score, so that's a positive thing. But, you know, he's got a finite number of goals left in him, you know, at the age he's in.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, you've only got so many. You've only got so many left. So I have to admire his refusal to waste any of them in a preseason game like this, because he knows that it's the goals he scores during the season that will count. You know, he's just making sure that when it comes down to the crunch, he's still got some gold jizz left in him. You know what I mean?
Sure,
not completely dried up.
Can we freeze his goals? Can we freeze his goals and keep them and artificially inseminate the goals into
games?
I don't know, Balogun or something down the line. Yeah.
There's an image.
Gary Lineker used to have a thing reputedly where he wouldn't score in the warm-up, and it does feel a bit like Aubameyang's now just applying that to friendly matches. I mean, some of the misses were extraordinary. There were a couple that I was like, and he has got those in his locker. We have seen them from time to time. Mm. But, you know, they you certainly raised your eyebrows at a couple of these. I almost think they were almost so bizarre that I don't sort of read too much into them. But, yeah, they were curious, weren't they?
Mm, yeah, I mean, there was one where I think he was just a bit too casual. Could have been, I can't remember exactly whose cross it was, but, you know, sort of fell to him and you're going, well, here's a goal. And then it's like, well, how has that not gone in? But, you know, if we are looking...
What he put over, wasn't there, from like the corner of the 6-yard box? Yeah. And then there was a header.
Yeah, he didn't really connect properly. Yeah, look, it's one of those things where if you win a preseason game, everyone says, well, it doesn't matter because it's just preseason game. If you lose, it's terrible because you've lost. But there is some little balance to be found, isn't there, in the work that you do in preseason, in terms of, like, you're looking for things to work on or to give you a platform. And if there is anything positive to be taken from the game against Rangers, I think it is that we did create more chances than we usually do. It's not that we've never done it before, but under Mikel Arteta, we are a bit chance light, if you know what I mean. So the fact that we did create lots of chances is a good thing. Now, got to do that in the next game and the next game and all the games. But, you know, if you give Aubameyang, typically if you give him that many chances in a game, you're going to get goals.
Yeah, I think it was interesting as well that Aubameyang played centrally. I mean, Balogun and Aubameyang were both in the team, and I thought, you know, maybe a more natural orientation would be to have Balogun through the middle and Aubameyang out wide. But the fact that Arteta didn't do that suggests that he's now pretty wedded to the idea of using Aubameyang through the middle. And I guess, if you were looking for the positives, you'd say, well, he was getting on the end of stuff. Mm. He just wasn't converting it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought, you know, that there is some encouragement to be drawn there. I personally think that Aubameyang will kind of pick things up a bit next season. I don't think we're going to see the kind of inexorable decline continue. Famous last words and all that. But
yeah.
I think there was a lot going on last season. And I suspect if there has been any decline, I don't think it's quite as grave as it may have looked at times last year. I don't know, though. You know, that's just my hunch.
I hope it's a good hunch, because if we are to make the kind of improvements we'd like to see, an Aubameyang in form would be basically a necessity. A necessity, yeah. No? Because, you know, we do have Lacazette still on the books. Whether he'll be here for the entire season remains to be seen. Balogun is obviously a very promising young player. Eddie Nketiah has scored, but it looks like his future is going to be elsewhere. Gabriel Martinelli, somebody else. So, you know, when it comes to players that you might consider a sure thing in terms of a certain amount of goals a season, let's say 20 goals, and I know we fell short of that last season for reasons that you've outlined, you know, he really is one of the only ones, I would say, who you would bank on scoring a specific number of goals, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I agree. And, you know, we need more from him. So fingers crossed that hunch is not just optimism.
Yeah.
It could be. But yeah, Eddie Nketiah did get his goal, which I think is probably a good thing, even though it's a friendly. It doesn't hurt to remind potential suitors of the quality he has inside the penalty box, and he took it well. Who knows? You know, it might just bring a bidder to the table.
Who knows? Yeah, or at least make Crystal Palace stick the $2 million they took off back on. I mean, they've paid fairly substantial money for a young centre half from from Chelsea, who, you know, I know he had loan spells, but he made two appearances for Chelsea, just two appearances for Chelsea, and they've spent nearly £18 million on him.
Yeah, so he was excellent, apparently, for Swansea in the Championship. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, listen, I was laughed out of town for my £18 million for Nketiah, but I do think that an English potential goal scorer should be pretty valuable. I mean, you know, we really ought to be getting at least 15 million for him. I really do think that.
Yeah. I mean, I did write about this this morning in the blog, if people want to have a read, but it's about selling and how we sell and needing to improve the way we sell. And that, you know, while we're all looking at who we're going to bring in and who is going to arrive to make the team better, who we sell and how we sell them and how much we sell them for is also going to be a way to have some judgment on the work that the club/technical director have done or will do during the transfer window, right?
Yeah, it's a big part of the job this summer. And Nketiah is probably one of the most saleable assets. I mean, sort of my personal view on it is that those players, the young English players, are probably where we should be doing the best deals. You know, I mean, I understand the frustration of, oh, we can't get what we want for Xhaka. But if you look at Xhaka's age and the kind of clubs that are interested in buying him, you can kind of understand why it might be tricky to get what we feel he is worth. But people like Nketiah, and to an extent, people like, you know, Alex Iwobi before him, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, Joe Willock, these kinds of players, I think, are where we should really be able to make our money. And given the fact these players have come through the academy, it's all profit. So,
yeah,
you know, those are hugely important deals for this club, and I hope we can extract the maximum from them.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Look, Nketiah has whatever amount of first-team appearances for us. I should have looked this up, but, like, he's certainly got more than two, you know, than the Chelsea guy had. So Reece Nelson, similar, like, maybe not quite as many, but, you know, these are guys with plenty of top-level experience, European experience as well, let's not forget. I know it's just the Europa League, but certainly
some international pedigree in Nketiah's case.
So Nketiah is you know, 65 appearances for the Arsenal first team. 13 wow. goals. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously had 19 appearances for Leeds with 5 goals. You know, he has got the potential to be certainly a transfer that we could, if we do it right, make some money off. I'm coming around to your line of thinking on this one. I got
to
give you.
I think we have to. I think we have to try, certainly. And, you know, if we can't get money for him, I don't know who we're going to get money for.
I mean, the only thing you would say that might make it a little more of an issue is the fact that he only has a year left on his contract.
Yeah, and the club obviously tried to remedy that, and he's obviously not going to go for that.
No. So that is
an extension.
Yeah, that is something that we have to reckon with, you know. But again, that comes down to what we do with players, what we do with player contracts, and when we make decisions on players. Reece Nelson says here he has a contract till 2023, although I have seen it reported that the contract ends next year. So I'm not 100% sure what's going on with that one.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's next year too, and that the club were trying to extend it in similar fashion to Nketiah, just to give them more options. I don't think it would be, you know, purely so they can then flog him, but I think it would give them the option of sending him on loan or whatever it might be.
And look, Nelson, 47 appearances for Arsenal, 4 goals, 29 appearances for Hoffenheim during his loan spell there, 7 goals. You know, there's some value in that experience. Like, if, you know, Liverpool have extracted 20-odd million pounds from Sheffield United for a player who never even played for them, you know. Mm-hmm. So if those are the benchmarks in a very broad sense, it would be disappointing if we weren't able to sell these guys for decent money this summer, regardless of who we bring in. If we can't get value from these assets that we've basically decided we're willing to part with, that would be a disappointing part of the summer, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing to say is that there may be aspects of this market, although it's very difficult, that can work to our favour, because I've certainly heard about clubs who, while they have very little cash to pay up front this year, in some instances are prepared to pay slightly over the odds over the longer term. Do you know what I mean? So they might make a 5-year commitment to a slightly higher fee than they would pay, you know, if they paid more of it up front. So I think Arsenal can probably, more than other Premier League clubs, afford a little bit of, you know, grace with the payment terms. And if that means in the longer term they get more money, then that could be a good thing. But yeah, it's, I feel like our transfer business, and there have been developments, obviously. I mean, there was news about Ben White, seemingly a deal is agreed at this point. But there are other areas of the squad which I do think are probably quite contingent on players going. You know, you look at right back, for example, the sheer number of players we have in that position, maybe even central midfield to an extent with the Granit Xhaka thing, who knows. But I do think that there's a degree to which that is probably holding up kind of the second wave of our transfer business a little.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think it is going to be really interesting, because as yet we don't have any real evidence as to how good Edu is at brokering deals for players to leave the club. I mean, we have some scant evidence, and it doesn't necessarily suggest that he's going to pull some big transfer fees out of the hat. You know, when you look at Guendouzi last year, we loaned him. We've done the loan with the obligation to Marseille this year. Saliba, a couple of loans. We sold.
Paid a lot of people off.
Yeah, we paid a lot of people off. I mean, anybody could do that. Give me a bag of cash and a gold carriage clock, and I can make anyone go away if you want. You know, there was the Saliba loan, and then the sale of Amy Martinez last year, which looks increasingly like a bargain for Aston Villa. So
I think that was a reasonable offer at the time. You know, I mean, he had a good few months at Arsenal.
Yeah. No,
but it was still a lot of money for that player then. Of course, what's followed, he's worth more now. But I can see why they felt they had to accept that, given that he was basically giving the club an ultimatum.
Sure. I'm just sort of including it as, you know, the deals that Edu has done in his role as technical director.
Oh, listen, and another 10 million on the top wouldn't have been insane and would have been nice. So, you know, I'm not denying that. But it is a worry. It is a worry. And I don't really know quite what the kind of delineation of responsibility is with these player sales. You know, I don't know, especially with Richard Garlick now there. I've got a fair idea about how the club are doing their incoming business, and a lot of that is being led by Garlick. A lot of the talking, a lot of the bids seems to go through him. I would imagine the same must now be true on the sales front. But you know, we're yet to see much concrete evidence there. It's tricky because on the one hand, I do have part of me that still wants to say, well, it's still relatively early days. You know, there's a lot of dominoes still to fall. But I feel like if we keep saying that on podcasts before we know it, the window will be up.
And we're just sort of looking at dominoes going, they didn't fall.
Oh, yeah. What happened to, stuck, you know, fucking gravity?
Fucking dominoes. Yeah. Let me ask you this then. What did you make of the social media posts with Edu on a yacht with Kia and Raul? How do you think that will have been perceived within the club?
Probably not particularly well, but I guess from Edu's perspective, they're his friends and he probably feels entitled to hang out with his friends. I think it was a purely social occasion. It was somebody's birthday.
Kia's 50th birthday, I believe.
Right, there you go. I think, to be honest, it's more interesting with the kind of retrospective view. It tells us more about the relationships that exist between, you know, Jarabchi and Edu and Sanjay, which we knew about anyway. But it's sort of confirmation of that more so than it is something that worries me about Arsenal's immediate future.
Sure. But would you question the wisdom of those kind of social media posts being made, given the scrutiny that was applied to, you know, the relationships, you know, not too long ago? I mean, maybe this time last year, you know, people were looking at those relationships and wondering, what's this? Is this great? And then, you know, it all goes a different direction and you're still at the club. You must be aware that there has been scrutiny again.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
So do you just not care when stuff like that is posted?
Help me out with this. Did Edu put them out himself?
No, I think they came from Edu's wife's Instagram. There's like this idea, well, no, I can't tell you what not to do. But I think, you know, when you're in a high-profile role like he is, it would just be better to say, look, let's enjoy the party with our friends and let's not rattle any cages. Don't have to make every single thing you do public or in the public domain.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. I think Edu's perspective on it is that he feels he has nothing to hide and therefore, you know, why should he behave in that way? He's from his perspective, he's like, I've always been open. I have relationships with agents.
Yeah.
Why should I disguise that? But I do think it's a little bit awkward and uncomfortable. I kind of almost think more so in the case of Sanjay, given that he was essentially booted out of the club, the idea that he's still moving in those circles, I think would trouble maybe the ownership and the board at Arsenal. Especially if they felt he was exerting any kind of influence. But I don't think that is particularly the case. As for Kia, I mean, you know, as we know, Edu and Kia go way back. The only positive I can derive from it is that we may need Kia on side to get rid of some of his clients. You know, Edu and Kia may have to collaborate to find a solution in the case of Willian or Cedric or whoever it might be.
Yeah.
So at least that relationship is intact enough for that to be a possibility.
Look, I don't think your personal relationships can exist outside the auspices of your professional ones, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just the optics of it. It's the
It's awkward for sure.
Yeah,
it's awkward. A bit.
I just wonder if it's a bit dim, you know, and that makes me worried about other stuff.
Yeah, although I do feel I have this sort of instinct about Edu, and it's purely instinct, that he's a bit of a survivor. I have this sense the manner in which he managed to kind of extricate himself from all the awkwardness at Arsenal last summer and attach himself sufficiently to Mikel Arteta, to me suggests someone who is quite adept and is quite political. And I guess that's why it's surprising, but then, you know, that he would be pictured in this situation. But then maybe, as I said before, he just feels covering it up would be more absurd. In a way.
Yeah, but look, I mean, I think there's another element to this as well, is that last year Arsenal lost their head of football technical director in the middle of the transfer window, and it certainly had some kind of impact on what we did and or didn't do, right? Because no matter how well set up you think you are when you lose somebody in a very high profile position, you're sort of back to square one. You're trying to figure out who does what, who's responsible for what. You know, there's no way that Arsenal could go through the same thing again, you know? Even if KSE were really, really pissed off by the pictures, they couldn't again, surely, get rid of a technical director in the middle of a transfer window, particularly one as crucial as this one, you know? So
no, definitely
a bit
not.
Of a safety net there.
And also, I think they couldn't really for a picture. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think it would be...
kind of crazy. I think it's one of those things that's a bit awkward, leaves a bit of an unpleasant taste in the mouth, but ultimately he's within his rights to do whatever he wants in his personal life, you know. It's just, I mean, ultimately he'll be judged on the business that he does. And arguably, I think we've probably got more to be worried about on that front than anything else.
Yeah, August 31st is September the 1st is the day of real judgment for Edu, isn't it, in terms of how we view the work that he has done. I mean, here's a question from Alex, who's at AlexCullen17. He said, are either of you concerned that the season is a matter of weeks away and our two biggest problem areas, a starting central midfielder and attacking midfielder, are left unfilled with no signings looking imminent? Because you mentioned Ben White, and that looks like it's going to get done. Lokonga, I think that's pretty much done.
Yeah. Tavares is done.
But still, these two really, really important positions where I think maybe there's a little bit of leeway or a little bit of grace with the attacking midfield signing. Maybe that's one. Yeah, because we've got Emile Smith Rowe. And you could say, well, look, we could go to the end of the window to try and broker a deal for the player we really want, because we've got Smith Rowe for those first three games. The issue isn't Smith Rowe playing three games. It's Smith Rowe being your only creative outlet for an entire season, right? So you do have a little bit more leeway with that signing. It's the central midfield starter alongside Thomas Partey that I think is the one that many people are hanging their hats on, with all due respect to Mohamed Elneny. You know, he's not the guy that's going to excite people going into a new season. That will feel, and this isn't his fault, extremely underwhelming if the midfield partnership for the first game or first three games of the season is Partey and Elneny.
Yeah, and likewise, I don't think Lokonga is going to be in a position to kind of take up that mantle and hasn't been bought to be that guy straight away. I think, you know, the Xhaka question is a significant one here, but all signs point towards him eventually getting that move. And so, you know, arguably we probably needed someone before that. We certainly will need someone after that. That is probably the one that concerns me most. I mean, I would love a creative midfielder. I would love a number 10. But it's got to be the right player and it's got to be the right fit. It's got to be someone who doesn't completely block Emile Smith-Rowe's path, someone who can work with him. I can see that that's tricky. I think central midfielder, they have to do a backup goalkeeper. They have to do the rest would be nice, but it's feasible, I think, to survive without. And I think in the case of the number 10, I mean, you know, we know they went into the window with Odegaard as the main target. We know that that doesn't look particularly likely right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal leave the door ajar for him as long as is feasible, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we had a question here, a couple of questions about this position, actually. From the Discord, Ash Richards 90 said, if you were Arteta and had a choice of signing Odegaard or Maddison as our central attacking midfielder, which one would you go for? And Rikunulu, oh, I can't pronounce that. Hang on. That's Rikuhurula on the Discord as well. He says, which of these scenarios regarding a new creative midfielder do you think is the most likely to happen? Arsenal sign James Maddison. Arsenal sign Houssam Aouar. Arsenal sign someone who they have not yet been linked with. Arsenal sign no new creative midfielder. Or Arsenal bring in a creative midfielder on loan. So which do you think is the most likely of those?
I think they bring someone in on loan or someone that they've not been linked with. You know, I've never really bought the James Maddison thing, I have to be honest with you. I personally have no information to suggest that is likely. And I think I would. I think that I'm sure he would love to come to Arsenal, but I'm not sure how reciprocal that is. And I think Houssam Aouar, Arsenal, there hasn't been any serious interest from Arsenal since the summer transfer window last year.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well.
Which is, I think, odd, I'll be honest. Like, he is a really gifted player. He profiles incredibly well from a statistical point of view. He has great flexibility in terms of where he can play. He can play in a midfield three. He can play as number 10. He can play off the left as well. Mm. So whether Arsenal play a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, there are various positions that he can kind of rotate and operate in, work alongside Smith Rowe. He's cheap in real terms because French football is absolutely fucked, as we know.
Yeah.
So...
why do you think, I mean, what's changed? If we were so after him last season and we were on the brink of signing him last season as well, what's changed in the meantime? Like, is it that we've got, have we been smitten by Odegaard to the point where we would prefer to do that rather than Aouar?
Yeah, I mean, well, what I heard was that things had come up in the scouting on and off the field that made Arsenal feel like they didn't want to pursue their interest. I don't know any more detail than that, I'm afraid. And I don't know the player well enough to say what that might be. I think, nonetheless, it is odd. It reminds me a little bit of the sort of Thomas Lamar thing, where we were sort of prepared to put our house on this player and then never went back for him. And it's weird how football has these moments where you're prepared to smash your transfer record for a guy who 6 months later you're not even interested in. Very odd. Mm. Very odd that that happens. But it does occasionally happen. If it was me and my money, I think he's the one I would go for. Granted, I don't know everything the club knows, but it feels like an opportunity to get a very high calibre player who we wouldn't ordinarily get, to be honest, but given that we're out of European football, at a very attainable price.
Yeah.
But the original question, the first question you asked me was, what would I do if I was Mikel Arteta? And I feel like the answer to that is always going to involve the words Martin Odegaard, because I think he's enamoured with that player. And I think what he brings off the pitch as well as on it, kind of in contrast to Aouar, is part of his appeal. And basically, Madrid have to prove to Odegaard that they're serious about using him.
Mm.
And for that, for him to get the answers he needs on that, the season has to be underway. So I think it's likely that Arsenal will give it until the season starts to see what his position is, because when he wasn't playing in January last year, he was very clear about going and knocking on Perez's door and saying, I want to go out on loan. And I think if he's not playing in August, he'll do the same, and Arsenal stand to benefit from that. But it's quite a big if, to be honest, because it does feel like he's had quite considerable assurances about his involvement at Madrid next season.
It sounds like he has, you know, to release the statement he did a couple of weeks ago, which more or less made it clear he was not going to be returning to Arsenal. You know, I think if you, as a player, leave the door open or have the door open to that possibility, you don't release that kind of a statement. You know, you could put something out, I guess, which, you know, isn't quite as definitive as you know, what he did put out. So,
yeah, my interpretation of it is it's almost like a game of bluff, like that he has been told by Madrid, yeah, we want you involved next season. And so it feels a bit like he's put that statement out as if to be like, okay, then let's see what you're, let's see if you're as good as your word. It almost feels like there's a bit of mistrust there. Maybe he's been given these assurances in the past and it hasn't come to pass. We know Madrid is quite a chaotic club.
Mm.
So I think there's almost a game of kind of like chicken or something, you know, to kind of see, are you as good as your word? I mean, I think they will be. Why would they not use him? They're at the start of a rebuild. He's a really talented young player who they've invested considerable time and money in already. They should absolutely be looking to integrate him properly next season.
But they are crazy, yeah.
Yeah, they are. And they are crazy, yeah. So I think that as long as there's a chance... You know that sort of thing of, so you're saying there's a chance. Yeah, I think that's Mikel Arteta and Martin Odegaard. But what were the other ones? On someone on loan? Yeah. I mean, I basically think it's a really... It seemed very straightforward a year ago that Arsenal needed this creative player. And I think it was. But I do think that everything that's gone on with Smith Rowe, in terms of his emergence, in terms of the interest from elsewhere, in terms of having to give him a sizable new contract... I don't think it assuages the need for someone, but it does maybe change the question, you know, from who should be Arsenal's number 10 to who is a good fit to work alongside Smith Rowe in the same squad. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like I said, I think we do have a bit more time to sort that one out. The other central midfielder, I think, is going to be...
Yeah, that's more pressing.
I mean, do you have any information on anything that's going on? I heard or I read somewhere that... Edu, obviously we've been trying to pursue Locatelli, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen. I don't think that was ever likely, even if Arsenal were to agree with Sassuolo. What the player wants, I think, is not us. It's
blindingly obvious. Yeah.
So that makes that really complicated. But I did read last week that Edu is apparently in constant contact with George Mendes, another very kind and lovely man, also a super agent, who represents Ruben Neves. So is that one maybe back on the table?
I think that's always been an option for sure. And I can't remember if I reported it like this or not, but my understanding was always that it was kind of one that Arsenal might come back to late, depending on what happens with Xhaka. And maybe what happens with Locatelli. I mean, that I like the ambition of going for Locatelli, I'll be honest. He looks like a really terrific player. And I like the idea that we'd be prepared to push the boat out for him. It just reminds me of, remember when Arsenal spent the summer chasing Julio Baptista and he always wanted Real Madrid? And in the end, he got Real Madrid. It feels a bit like that. I just don't really think it's a realistic prospect. And maybe... In fact, there was a report in Sky Italy last week saying if he doesn't get Juve, he'll stay with Sassuolo. You know, he wants to go to Juve at some point, if it's now or next summer, depending on the finances, so be it. So it's difficult to get too invested in that one. I just think it's a long shot of long shots. Neves feels much more doable Wolves need to sell somebody this summer. They've already sold Patricio, but they probably need to sell one of Neves or Traore, from what I hear. It feels like a fit, you know. It feels like he would want the move. It feels like they're stylistically, he kind of replaces a little of what Xhaka does. The age profile is in the right ballpark. The fee is in the right ballpark. I mean, yeah, if you ask me to put my money on it, I'd say it will eventually be him. But, you know, as you say, someone's got to play at the start of the season.
Yeah. Yeah. So they do have to make a decision on that one pretty quickly, I think. You know, to give whoever it is some time to adapt, et cetera, et cetera. What date is it today? It's the 19th of July.
So about 6 weeks out, are we slightly under?
Yeah, well, start of the season is the 13th of August. So,
right, you so know, less than a month from that.
If you want a new, if you want the party partner, you know, you want him to start the season. That's a signing that you want to start the season, surely.
You'd like that, but then if you think about it, I mean, look at what Arsenal did in the last summer window in terms of having to trigger Thomas Partey's release clause literally on the final morning of the window. I think, you know, I think we know about this, the people running this show here, that they are going to use brinkmanship and they're going to
be indecisive.
Yeah.
That's one
well,
way.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, but they've not been indecisive about Ben White. I mean, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? They clearly were convinced in that case, sufficiently convinced to spend an awful lot of money.
Yeah. Well, look, we'll have more transfer talk, I think, in part two. Just going back, was there anything else we needed to talk about from the two games in Scotland, or have we done that to death? Is there anything?
I think we've kind of done it to death. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think there's some good questions coming up in part two, so let's get straight into them.
All right, we will take a break. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. Do you mind if I go first? Would that be okay?
No, that's absolutely fine.
We've had quite a lot of questions about Nicolas Pepe. Now, I thought he was good against Hibs. He was good against Rangers as well. So John B says, what are you expecting from Pepe this season? I've got a feeling he's going to do big things this year. He seems ready. Arsenal Nair says, tagged you in this once, here it is again. Pepe hasn't played a full season in front of a crowd yet. Signed 2019, football shut down March 2020. Hasn't been full crowds back yet. Could this have affected his integration? And we also have one from at Geezy Peas, who says, why doesn't Pepe tend to get mentioned when talking about players to build the evolution of this team on? I know he had a slow start, but I think he's really settled now. He's just turned 26, has another 3 years on his contract, and for me, is actually our best player. Now, some people might take exception or a difference of opinion with him being our best player, but it is an interesting point, isn't it, about his profile in terms of this rebuild, and as one of the cornerstones of a rebuild, he is exactly the profile that you're looking for.
Yeah, he is. And he's one of the few players in the squad who's in that age bracket, really. You know, not in his early 20s starting out, not in his 30s coming towards the end. He's kind of in his prime right now. And actually, his numbers are very good. I mean, if you look at last season in the Premier League, he scored 10 goals, but he only made 16 starts. Similarly, in the Europa League, he scored 6 goals and only made 10 starts. Overall, factoring in his 16 or so substitute appearances he made, I think he scored 16 goals in 50-odd appearances. So it's close to 1 in 3, one goal in every 3 appearances, which is a very good return for someone who's not starting that many games. I think the reason he's not, part of the reason he's not talked about as fondly or maybe as much part of the plan, I think there's the slight question over him and Bukayo Saka. You know, for the majority of last season, they played in the same part of the pitch.
Mm.
And, you know, Saka's shone for England playing in that position too. I think there's a bit of uncertainty over exactly who is going to get the nod there and what that would mean for Saka if it's Pepe.
Yeah, I just feel like Saka and Pepe shouldn't be an either-or situation for this club.
No, it shouldn't be, I agree.
You know, I know why it has been, but I think one of the things that Mikel Arteta, you know, has to think about is, like, we talked about Aubameyang, right, as a player who, all going well, would guarantee you a certain amount of goals. Nicolas Pepe, I think he's a potentially more than this, but, you know, more or less a 10 to 15 goal a season player in all competitions.
Yeah, he should
right?
be. He should be.
I think he is. What has he got? Well, 24 goals. Yeah, he should be maybe 10 to 15 goals a season minimum, I think, for him. But that gives you some amount of guarantee. So he is a player that if you're the manager of a team that doesn't score enough goals, that doesn't create enough chances, he's a player you want in your team. So too is Bukayo Saka, because he scores goals and he makes chances as well. So to maximize your efficiency or whatever you want to call it, those two players need to be factored into your first team thinking, I reckon. And not, well, we'll start the season with Pepe there because, you know, Saka needs a rest, and he does, and we all know why and understand why. But when Saka's fit again, I don't think, unless Pepe's playing terribly, it should be a case that he comes back into the team to relegate Pepe to the bench, you know?
No, I mean, if you're picking a team based on the 11 best players in the squad, you'd certainly have them both in it. I mean, I think if you were picking a team based on the 5 best players in the squad, there's a chance you might have them both in it.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're right. They need to find a way for them both to be on the field. And I think that's possible. You know, they can both play, as of last season, both sides. Pepe had some really good games on the left as well as some good games on the right. And Saka has done previously. I just think in terms of why he's not talked about in those terms I do wonder if kind of the devotion to Saka that the fan base understandably feel might be part of that. I also think that it's hard to change people's minds in football. And Pepe flopped in his first season, basically. He was a disappointment and it felt like too much money. And however well he may have done since then, I just think people... Some of that lingers. Some of that feeling and that sense of like mistrust endures. And I think that's probably unfair, to be honest, because, you know, as Ricky says, I think he's been very, very good, particularly in the last few months. So, an interesting one. How would you set them up to get the best out of both of them?
It's a good question. I suppose it depends on what formation you're going to play, because you can talk about both of them being able to play on the left, but I do think Saka can play in more positions than Pepe. Yeah. And I wonder, and I'm sure I've said this before, that I wonder if Saka will ultimately end up more central for us than a wide player. Because I think he's got the ability to play as an eight, if you like. So how would I set them up together? I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. But I feel like that's something that Arteta's got to find a way to do. He could easily play Saka on the left-hand side of the front three. Saka, Aubameyang, Pepe, pretty tasty to me. I know that
Smith Rowe in there too.
Smith Rowe is your one behind. But what do you expect from Pepe? Do you feel like he is a player who has earned the trust of Mikel Arteta, because it felt a bit like that towards the end of his first season, and I think there were a number of mitigating factors as to why his first season was not as successful as we had hoped. Mm-hmm. You know, when you say he was a flop in his first season, I get it, but, you know, new country, new language, new team, new style of play, a manager who didn't really want him, who sort of made it clear that he didn't really want him as well, by talking up the player that he did want, who was also an international colleague. You know, the Emery thing falling apart, Arteta coming in, lockdown, all of those things, isn't to make excuses, but it's to sort of lay out why that first season might have been difficult for him. But he ended strongly. He ended it strongly. He was great in the FA Cup final, and it looked like he had bought into whatever it was that Mikel Arteta was looking for. And then we did the stupidest thing that this club has done in quite some time. And that's really saying something, because we've done some things. Man, have we done some things. But we brought Willian in to play in his position, which I think must have affected his confidence. By the end of the season, though, he was playing well. He was scoring goals. He was creating chances for others. And it felt like, okay, maybe it's clicked for him now. It's clicked between him and the manager. It's clicked, you know, with him at the club. He now feels settled and happy enough. So those are promising signs ahead of next season, assuming we don't do something stupid, which you can't rule out.
No. And what do I expect from him? To be honest, more of the same. I expect he'll still have games where he frustrates people, or certainly moments where he frustrates people. But I think he'll still be productive. And I think if he plays enough football, he'll get 15 goals. And those will be very valuable to us, because we're not a team blessed with loads of goal scorers. So I think, I'm not going to say he's going to go stratospheric this season and he's going to have his Mo Salah breakout season where he scores 40 goals and, you know, wins the Ballon d'Or or something. I don't predict that. I don't doubt that he's got the ability, but, you know, to go through that kind of transition, I think takes so much more than just talent.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that will happen, but I don't think that should detract from how useful he can be for us. I mean, ultimately, we've said it so many times, we're a team that don't score enough goals. Therefore, the people who are the goal scorers, you know, are very, very precious to us, and he's one. And so we need to get him on the field as often as possible.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's have another question. Okay, Husama Wa, we've done this. We had this from Fred on Twitter, who's at RLF86, which I quite enjoyed, who said, given how much coverage there is of friendlies these days and the strange fascination people have over losing a game, putting it politely, do you think we'll ever see the day when a team sack their manager over poor results during pre-season friendlies?
It must have happened, surely, already. No, it must have happened at some point somewhere in the world where, you know, a coach who was maybe hanging on got shit canned right. somewhere. But, like, you couldn't really be... Like, if you got beaten 7-0 by Hibernian and 8-0 by Rangers and you go and you play Inter Milan, you lose 12-0 or whatever, you know, you can't just use out the, well, it's only preseason, because, you know, the level of defeat was so high. But, you know, that's not what happened, and that is very unlikely to happen. So that's the only way I could actually see that being a realistic thing, where, you know, a team just want to get rid of a manager and do something.
I think that's plausible. I think that is plausible that, you know, they talk about a manager losing the dressing room. I think you could probably see that even in a pre-season game. Mm. And if you think, place it in context of other things that would presumably be happening in the club, other conversations that would be going on, a manager losing his job. I think a manager coming into a club and losing it before he's had his first competitive game, I think that's extremely unlikely. But like you say, a manager under pressure or under fire who isn't producing a reaction in pre-season, I could certainly see that leading to a sacking, yeah.
Mm. Okay, here's one from Selbridge Gooner, who's at Selbridge Gooner. And he says, do Arsenal fans have a little bit of snobbishness, believing that our technical style of play doesn't suit Joe Willock, but he would suit a lesser side like Newcastle?
I actually don't think that's about being a lesser team. I think it's more about style. Like, you know, if Joe Willock went to a great counter-attacking team who were competing for the title, I think he would still be a better fit in some ways for them than he would for a possession-based team, which is what Mikel Arteta seemingly wants. Mm. So it just so happens that the way football is that, you know, teams in the lower reaches of the leagues adopt that style more frequently. But, you know, I think... Is it snobbish? I definitely think there is a bit of a snobbishness among football fans generally about their own divisions. I do think, you know, we're much kinder on European leagues and European players than we are some that are closer at hand, if I was speaking in very general terms. But I think... No, I don't think this is snobbishness about Willock. I think actually it's quite a nuanced and intelligent discussion because, you know, we've just said we're a team that lack goals and Joe Willock's just been on a great run of goal-scoring form. And I think if we were being very simplistic about it, we would just do that equation and go, therefore, Joe Willock must stay. But actually, the fact that there is more discussion amongst the fan base and more debate around that, to me, suggests that we're actually looking at it in quite a sort of broad, holistic way that encompasses all facets of his game, you know?
I think the Willock one is really fascinating because, you know, the argument that his value will never be higher is probably true. Maybe it's true, who knows? But, you know, right now you can see it's not too dissimilar from the Emi Martinez situation.
Yeah, and it could be the same. I mean, who you know, Emi Martinez was pretty underwhelming at Arsenal for many years, and a lot of Arsenal fans, not myself, but certainly some, have been very underwhelmed by Joe Willock. It doesn't mean, you know, players can always blossom in unexpected ways. But a bit like last year, if Arsenal get an offer of £20 million plus, it will be very tempting.
It will, and if they sell him and he goes and scores a load of goals, people will probably have something to say about that. I mean, I do get the point as well that, like, it was an unbelievable streak of goals that he went on. And those who say he will never do that again are probably right. But he doesn't have to do exactly that either. You know what I mean? He doesn't have to score seven games in a row. If Joe Willock gets you 7-8 goals in the Premier League from central midfield, that's a bigger return than we've had from all of our central midfielders combined for about 3 years. You know? So I'm not saying he would do that either. I think this is a really difficult one for the club to make a decision on. It will depend entirely on how much money is on offer from Newcastle. And it doesn't look like it's a lot because, you know, there's talk of a loan. Yeah. And there's some issues there with the ownership and what have you. So, you know, is Mike Ashley going to spend £30 million on a footballer when he's trying his best to sell the club? I'm not sure that he is, you know. So, it's an interesting one.
It is, and you know, he was there with the squad, wasn't he, in Scotland? And
yeah, he came on against Rangers.
Came on against Rangers. I mean, there's a decision to be made for sure, and also he'll have a perspective. I think, you know, he'll want to know where he stands, how much he's part of the plans. I don't think it's purely down to Arteta to Arsenal. Yeah. You know,
did he release a statement to say thanks to Newcastle fans, and did he make it clear that he wouldn't be coming back?
I think he did right at the end of the season, but it wasn't. Yeah. So, you know.
He left the door open. Smart guy. Here's another one, actually. A similar kind of territory. It comes from the Discord from Steam Pedals. And he says, are we fans guilty of being too attached to young players? I often find myself daydreaming of Smith Rowe, Saka, Martinelli et al. Playing their whole careers at Arsenal and delivering several quintuple campaigns. But when I think back to the last 30 years, many of our favourite gunners came to us as established senior players. Wright, Bergkamp, Pires, Cazorla, Mertesacker, etc. Are we too focused on the promise of youth?
Well, I mean, it comes back to slightly to the question about Pepe and, you know, why is he not held in the same esteem as some others? And it's very difficult to compete for the affections of fans with a player who has come through the academy. There is a kind of a completely natural and I would say reasonable bias towards them. You know, we want them to flourish and succeed. We see them as our own. They're not stained or damaged in any way by associations with other clubs. They're basically free. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's natural and right even for a club to kind of lean into its academy and the supporters to want those players to succeed.
They're the purest thing about football for a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they come from within. They're homegrown. They're club lads. They've grown up, you know, imbued with everything that the club can give them in terms of a footballing education, et cetera, et cetera. And they haven't, I think you just said it, they haven't done anything to disappoint us yet. And then they play for a while and then you see limitations or things about the game or their game that you don't like. And then, you know, all the gloves are off. Basically, they're just any other footballer at that point. But yeah, I think the promise of them is something that is in the cynical football world we live in right now. There is just something fundamentally pure and clean about a young player coming through to a, you know, a club like Arsenal. And of course, there's like historical precedent as well when you think of, you know, the generation of Tony Adams, Martin Keown, David Rowcastle, Michael Thomas, Paul Davies, all these players who made it through, you know, even someone like Liam Brady who came from Ireland but, you know, came to Arsenal at 15 or whatever it was, you know. Some of our treasured heroes are guys who've taken that exact path.
Yeah, you know, Tony Adams, whoever it might be. But I think it's interesting, you know, there are kind of different types of academy player. I think there are some, and I think I would say Saka is in this bracket, who are just of outstanding, stupendous quality, and in whom getting them through your academy is kind of winning the lottery, you know, and you know, they are there on merit. If they'd come from any other academy in Britain, you'd still be hoping your team bought them. And then I think there are others who kind of make up the numbers a little bit, or who might not ordinarily get that opportunity. I'm thinking of someone like Kieran Gibbs, for example, right? Who came through at Arsenal, impressed as a teenager, had a decent place in the first team squad, ultimately was fairly limited and superseded by Nacho Monreal, who was brought in. But over that period of time, he made a pretty decent contribution to Arsenal with no transfer fee, probably with pretty modest salary. He never got on. His career's gone nowhere since then with respect to him. I mean, he's not had a good time of it. He's now in America. He was with West Brom, but kind of in and out of the team, injury problems, etc. But for a period of time, he was just sort of useful to us. And I think that that's okay. I don't think they all can be or have to be Bukayo Saka. I think sometimes, you know, if we sell Ainsley Maitland-Niles this summer, he's done his job. He was a really handy, versatile squad player who got us out of holes, made big contributions in some really big games. It didn't work out. Here's a check, and stick that back into your academy and develop more players. I mean, that's fine too. Do you know what I mean? I just think there are kind of two tiers of academy player, and we shouldn't conflate them as one. They can't all be Bukayo Saka.
Yeah. That's fair. All right, I'll do another one here. This one comes from Dan Bannell, who's at Dan_Bannell. We talked about it a bit earlier, but he said, is Arteta's hiring of set-piece coach Jover another comfortable appointment as someone who won't challenge Arteta's ideals too much? My preseason overreaction is that defending set-pieces looks weak, and we're set to add Ben White, whose strength is not in the air. Just to sort of expand on that a little bit, the relationship between Mikel Arteta knows Nicolas Jover because they worked together for a period at Manchester City. So where do you view that? Like, is he just bringing in someone that he knows because that's comfortable, or is he bringing in somebody he knows is good and can help his team?
Well, he's bringing someone in from a pretty elite organisation, and one that doesn't appear to be built on people kind of resting on their laurels and not challenging each other. I mean, one of the things that I think is impressive about Manchester City is that they all managed to motivate themselves despite the vast amount of money they're presumably all sitting on. So that doesn't concern me. I think if we're bringing people in from Man City, tells you something about where we are maybe, but we should probably be pleased with that outcome. I think we are probably still in pre-season overreaction territory to get too worried about the set pieces. I was just thinking about it and thinking about the fact that obviously Gabriel isn't there at the moment. He will probably help in that regard. Cedric was playing at right back against Chambers. I mean, we concede a lot of height playing Cedric rather than Chambers. I'm saying, if we play Cedric rather than Chambers, we concede an awful lot of height. There's probably one or two more. I mean, Shaka's pretty good defensively on set pieces. Obviously, that's something we need to replace. So I think we've got to give it a bit more time before we sort of get out the placards saying fraud and hold them all up at the set piece catch.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I know you talked about this, didn't you, when you talked about the two... Was it you or was it Tim Stillman who was talking about this? Could have been Tim on the Arsenal Vision podcast, where last summer he brought in a couple of really young coaches who maybe, you know, because of their age and the point that they're at in their careers, wouldn't have any sort of authority that would be challenging to Arteta. And I could see
guys.
Young guys are going to be happy that they got their job, and like, they're not going to pipe up and start talking over the manager. But like, do you just hire a bunch of yes men, or are you looking for an environment which is challenging in some ways, which I think you kind of have to have? You need people to question you, whether you ultimately listen to them or not, is another thing. I don't think you learn as much if you've just got, yes boss, yes boss, yes boss, good idea boss, you know, people who can say, well, why not think about doing this? Think about this guy. Think about this scenario. You know, you need that. And I think if Mikel Arteta is serious about being a top-class manager, I don't know that he would miss out on that part of his education, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense? Like, did Mikel Arteta go to Man City and just say, yes, Pep, yes, Pep, yes, Pep? I'm not sure he did.
I highly doubt it. Yeah.
So I don't see why he, with far less achieved in the game than Pep Guardiola, would feel he is not in a position to be, again, I'm saying question, but you know what I mean? To have people on his staff who are going to bring different things to the table. So I just think he knew this guy. The other guy went off to become, what, sporting director at Malmo?
Yeah.
Which is a fairly significant
opportunity.
Yeah, for him. And we didn't stand in his way. So you know there's a guy who you think is good, is a good coach, is a specialist in an area you now need a specialist. You go get him. That would be my thinking.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I think he also isn't someone who places great stock. It's funny because he does seem to, or did seem to, in terms of players, in terms of experience. And, you know, if he felt he could come in and challenge Guardiola, having never been a coach before, maybe he expects the same of the likes of Carlos Cuesta and Molina, the two young coaches he brought in last year. It's one of those interesting ones where when you're losing games, it's very easy to say, like, you should put more experience around him, you know, and then he wins a few and you're like, wow, you know, it's all fine again. It's just, it's very hard for us to be specific about the dynamics between those coaches without experiencing them ourselves. But I generally think this guy sounds like quite an impressive hire. I don't think they wanted to lose Andreas Jorgensen. I think, like you say, it was a good opportunity for him and they've not stood in his way. But, you know, if you're going to bring in somebody from somewhere, let it be Man City. I mean, I guess what we should really be doing is looking at their set-piece record from last season and assessing it accordingly.
If only one of us had access to an analytics department for the publication we worked for.
I know. Well, I'm on holiday at the moment, Andrew. Take it up with Art de Rocha, you know.
Maybe I will. Have you got a question?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
This is an interesting question, which has come from Toby Lilyleaf on the Discord. And Toby says, are Arteta and Edu's future intertwined, or are there scenarios where they are judged independently?
I think they are quite intertwined, but I can see scenarios where one or the other could go without the other one going, you know? Mm. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised if this time next year, if we had a reasonable season, you know, we made some improvement, we got ourselves back into the Europa League, back into Europe, if we were there or thereabouts in terms of the top four conversation but fell short, you know, I don't think that's the kind of season Arteta has to have. So he would stay then, but I wouldn't be surprised if this time next year Edu was gone. Simply because I just have a funny feeling about that one. Similarly, it's much easier to see Arteta staying and Edu going than it is to see Edu or Arteta going and Edu not going as well.
But it's supposed to be the other way around, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the technical director is supposed to provide the stability and the five-year plan.
Mm. But, like, if at the end of the transfer window, I mean, we could be happy, but what if we get these players and they don't work? I mean, that's going to be on Arteta, obviously, as the manager. He won't be able to get the results. But I think it would also be, it would reflect on Edu because, you know, he's the technical director. He has said, whether it's on the record or not, but I think it has certainly been reported more than once that he has made himself the point of contact for all transfer business at Arsenal.
Mm.
So there's there's your line in the sand. That's who's responsible. So, you know, if we bring in a load of players and they don't do well, it's bad for Arteta, but it's also bad for Edu. Maybe another manager could get more out of them, but, you know, I feel like if Arteta goes, Edu would probably go with him. But I could see a scenario where Edu goes and Arteta doesn't.
Yeah, interesting. I think that in an ideal world, you would be able to judge them independently. But I don't know how you realistically do that. Like, is it the technical director's fault for the deal?
Mm.
Especially in a situation now where the manager, we know the manager has a significant input into the transfer business. Or is it, you know, if the manager can't get the best out of the player, then, you know, to what extent is that the technical director's fault? It's very, very closely linked. I mean, I think in an ideal world, you'd be able to separate them, but I don't think you reasonably can.
No, and I think that's because of how it came about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the sense that, it felt a little bit like when the changes happened last summer, that Edu was lucky to stay on.
Yeah, therefore, I mean, he clung to the life raft that was Mikel Arteta. Yeah. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, and that then diminishes his authority, no, in the position that he's in, because, you know, realistically, technical director should be, you know, above the manager or slash head coach. Again, there's the manager situation, the manager issue, you know.
Yeah, and again, like you sort of envisaged the technical director would be the guy who's got the close relationship with the board and the ownership, and the manager's maybe one step removed from that. But that's not really the case at Arsenal. That hierarchy isn't quite intact anymore. Mm. So I think they probably will be grouped and judged as one. And I have to say, I don't think either is in imminent danger. But I think if one is, the other will be sucked into it. I just can't see a way. unless Edu just doesn't get the business done.
Yeah, there's another scenario, yeah.
If he just doesn't get it done and Arsenal's results suffer, I think Arteta will, it will be a reasonable defence for Arteta to say, well, what happened, you know?
Yeah, here's a good question from the Discord from KT, who says, do you think the Willian situation unfairly tarnished perceptions of Edu and Arteta's work since Raul left? And he says, Gabriel, Partey, Odegaard, Tavares, Lokonga, White. That's a strong pool of targets, and to me there does seem to be a plan and a clear focus on younger players. Should we just relax and let them do their work? I mean, who can relax at the moment? Who crazy people can relax? But interesting point.
It is. I mean, I have to say, if we're going to be fair, Partey and Gabriel were both deals Sanyei had worked on, you know. It's not right to credit those. In fact, you know, a lot of the groundwork had been done by Sanyei, as had a couple of other things. I think the Aubameyang contract was one.
And to be fair, Partey, a player that was, heavily scouted and reported on by Francis Kadjigao as well, before he left.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that deal was kind of almost there to be done since 2018. You know, they talked about doing it for Unai Emery, and, you know, there's a real history with that one. Gabriel, Sanyei was very connected with Lille, as we know, and helped sort of smooth that deal over, get that over the line. But when you lay the list out like that, I mean, I actually think this more broadly about Arsenal, that if you look at the last few transfer windows, I do think the Willian deal maybe has an undue degree of weight within the analysis of those windows. Like, if you go back further than that, there are some really encouraging, promising signings of good young players.
Yeah. But there are also Cedric deals, you know. There's also David Luiz.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I'm saying for every Willian, there's a Kieran Tierney. For every Cedric, there's a Gabriel Martinelli. It's not the case that Arsenal have done exclusively bad things in the last few transfer windows. I think it's more even-handed than that. And I think if you look at, as the question asks, the last couple, since those two guys were at the helm, there's not too much there that many fans would take major issue with. I suppose where that becomes interesting is what changed. And I guess what changed is that Mikel Arteta went from head coach to manager. And maybe... this is a guess, but maybe he's had a fairly significant role in what Arsenal do and don't do. I don't know. It's again, in terms of analysing them individually, it becomes very difficult, doesn't it?
It does. But I think part of it is that there was an acceptance that we had to change. You know, why was Unai Emery brought in to replace Arsene Wenger? It was, you know, to bring in a relatively experienced manager, keep us more or less in the top four conversation. Maybe he could win us the Europa League and get us back in. But it was there's been a lot of, in recent years, it feels like Arsenal are desperately trying to roll sixes to just sort of stay in the game a little bit, to hang on to the coattails of other teams. Like, we're almost there. If we just did this, it might give us enough of a boost to get back. And we're at a point where that, you know, hasn't worked. It won't work. And you've got to do something different. So maybe this summer, seeing the ages of the players that we have been linked with, like, most of them are around 22, 23, 24, is part of that strategy that's been laid out. Whose plan that is, I don't know. Whether that's Arteta's plan, the club's plan. I don't know who at the club would have the plan if it wasn't Arteta, you know? So maybe that's what we're seeing playing out this summer. And again, we'll come to the end of the transfer window and we'll see how it all plays out. I think the last one for now.
Go on.
Why does Danny Mills hate Robert Pires so much? Did you see the comments?
Yeah, he invented diving or something.
Robert Pires was the first player to bring in serious diving in England, said Danny Mills.
Yes.
I Googled this just while we were talking. I Googled it because I just wanted to get that quote. And I see an article from 2016 on Eurosport. Danny Mills. Robert Pires brought diving into the English game. So this isn't even the first time he's gone off on this nonsensical bullshit. What's wrong with him? Why can't he let it lie? What did Robert Pires ever do to him other than make him look like the very average footballer he was?
Well, I think it's precisely that, isn't it? Danny Mills used to get a torrid time against Arsenal. Was there an incident where Thierry Henry absolutely humiliated him by the corner flag once? Like a nutmeg or something. I do think that, you know, he's been left with a few scars and a few sensitivities. But yeah, very strange. I mean, it's such a nonsense idea. I mean, you know, diving to an extent has always existed. I think it's obviously been exacerbated a bit in the modern game, but you know, you had Jurgen Klinsmann in the 90s coming over. You had Michael Owen in the 90s falling over at every opportunity.
Well, that's it. I remember when Ozzy Ardiles came to play for Spurs. Same thing. He was labelled a diver. And that was the 80s. I mean, Robert Pires arrived at Arsenal in the year 2000. Michael Owen jumped over an Argentinian defender's leg at the World Cup in 1998. Maybe Robert Pires was watching. Thought, that seems like a good idea. I'll have a go at that. But it is just nonsense, jingoistic, blame the foreigner for, you know, the thing you don't like because it doesn't connect with your sort of sensibilities as like a hard but fair English footballer. We would never do any of this. It's the foreigners. They took our jobs. That kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, and it's a classic instance of, like, there's one very high-profile example, isn't there, of Pires diving against Portsmouth.
And that's, yeah.
But, like, and I'm trying to be fair and reasonable in this, it's not something I recall, you know, he wasn't exactly, you know, going shoulder-to-shoulder with people and staying on his feet when he shouldn't, but I don't remember him throwing himself to the ground all the time.
No.
I honestly don't. And there have been Arsenal players I probably would say that about. You know, if I think of someone like Guendouzi, or to an extent Xhaka, I mean, they've made an art form of kind of buying free kicks.
Yeah.
And I don't think Pires was quite in that category. I just don't think he was. I think the Premier League wasn't was probably involved more contact in his time than it does now.
Mm.
So, yeah, I just don't quite see it. I think it's just, it sounds like quite an embittered evaluation on Mills's part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. Yeah, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? You know, it just does not stand up to any examination whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, if my only way of getting close to some of these players was kicking them, I'd probably accuse them of diving too. You know?
Do you want to hear some sad truth? That is the only way.
Yeah.
For you.
Well, that's it, and I'm sick of all these people diving when they play against me. Absolutely sick of it.
Especially if they come from somewhere else.
If they have a non-UK passport, then I'm absolutely incensed about the whole thing. Yeah, it's really odd.
Mm.
I mean, who cares what Danny Mills thinks, though? Do you know what I mean?
It's a very good point. Well made.
Not Robert Pires.
No, I think, you know, there were some responses back in the 2016 article where Robert Pires sort of hit back at Danny Mills, you know, classic tabloid hit back, but probably just refuted his suggestion that he was the one that brought diving to English football when, you know, clearly it's been part and parcel of the game for decades, you know, and it's just way too easy to blame Johnny Foreigner for what is perceived as, you know, gamesmanship, et cetera, et cetera. So, Anyway, fuck Danny Mills. And on that cheery note, we'll leave it there because the weather's warm and, you know, we should all get out and try and enjoy that warm weather. James, as always, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to everybody for listening, for being here, for downloading, supporting, joining us on Patreon and all the rest. Enjoy the summer. Hopefully we'll make some signings soon. It seems like the Lokonga thing is about to happen today.
Seeing
some pictures being posted and stuff, so it's already out of date, but hey, what can you do? Thanks again, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.